Welcome to the Easy EdTech Podcast with your host, Dr. Monica Burns.
Hello there, and welcome to today's episode of the Easy EdTech Podcast. If we haven't met before, my name is Monica Burns. I'm a former New York City public school teacher, and I've been out of the classroom for a few years, leading professional development for educators and writing about all things EdTech on my blog, classtechtips.com. Before we jump into today's episode, a quick reminder, you can head to my website, classtechtips.com/podcast for all of the show notes and resources from today's episode. And if you're listening to this episode on a podcast player like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, you should see a link in the description that you can click on as you listen today, and it'll take you to all of the resources I mentioned. Also, for those of you who have ordered a copy of my new book, EdTech Essentials, the Top 10 Technology Strategies for All Learning Environments, a big thank you. There are over a dozen five-star reviews on Amazon already, but because there were some big shipping delays for my publisher, ASCD, I have extended the book bonus through the end of October. So just check out the podcast description or go to classtechtips.com/books for more details. This episode is sponsored by Tech, and I'm so excited to partner with them for a webinar series this fall. It's totally free, and you can join one or all four of these webinars covering EdTech topics like creation in the classroom, assessment tips, and more. Register for the event or sign up to view the replays on their website. Just go to otispd.com. Click on Upcoming Events, and you'll find four free webinars you can join. That's otispd.com. You can also send me a DM on Instagram, and I'll make sure to get you the link. This week's episode is all about project-based learning and environmental education, and I'm so excited to have James Fester join in today. He wrote a new book, published by ISTE, all about this topic with George Valenzuela, who you might remember from episode 66 of the podcast last June. This topic of environmental education is near and dear to my heart. If you joined me for a webinar in the past or attended an event with me, you might have heard me tell the story of the worms, which is inspired by my work teaching in a school where we transitioned from a traditional public school to a magnet school, specifically with the theme of environmental stewardship. I'm a big fan of the national park system, have been all over the country visiting different spots, and as you'll hear me mention in this episode, I must follow a few dozen National Park Service Instagram accounts. And to end today's episode, you'll hear some actionable tips, some things you can try out right away, and some things you might want to investigate for interdisciplinary connection to environmental education throughout the school year. So let's dive in to this topic together with James's interview. All right. Well, welcome. Thank you so much for joining in on the podcast today. I am so excited to dive into this topic all about project-based learning and environmental education. But before we jump in, I'd love for you to introduce yourself and share a little bit about your role in education and what your day-to-day looks like.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. Yeah. So my primary role is I'm a national faculty member with PBL Works, which is a nonprofit based out of California that provides professional development for K-12 teachers and schools in the area of project-based learning. Been doing it for over 30 years. We've worked all over the United States with thousands and thousands of educators. And I really am lucky that I get to work with passionate educators and administrators and people from across the country, just kind of improving their practice and shifting to a more learner-centered, inquiry-based model of education. And, you know, to make sure that all students have the experience of high-quality PBL to help prepare them for whatever comes next after they're done with school. And that's kind of what I do. That's my primary role. My secondary role is I do a lot of work focused on informal and place-based education with a number of different organizations. So I'm working currently with National Geographic. I'm a grantee with them working on a project to help develop virtual tours for students to visit, you know, different parts of our country. I also am a volunteer and working with the National Park Service to help improve the quality of the educational offerings. And this year I'm a part of their Teacher Ranger Teacher program, helping to create more PBL-like educational programs, both remote and in-person in parks across the country. So yeah, I'm really passionate about all things student-centered learning and PBL, and of course, things that connect to environmental science as well, like I write about in the book.
That's wonderful. And I'm excited to hear. I want to learn more about that National Park Service connection too. I have to say, whenever I'm talking to teachers about Instagram, I always say the first people that you should follow are all the parks have such great Instagram accounts. It just makes you want to run off and go someplace. Plus they're really, a lot of them are really funny too. They're just the way they do use graphics and all that. So how wonderful is that? So, you know, I'm just excited to chat today about project-based learning and environmental education. There are two topics that I featured on the blog in the past, you know, a few times talking about PBL. Listeners of the podcast might remember that I had my former colleague, Tina Wong, on the podcast last year talking about environmental education and ed tech specifically. But before we jump into some of the PBL connections, I'd love to hear a bit, you know, I have PBL connections in the book, I should say, but, you know, how do you currently see environmental education taught in schools right now?
Yeah, there's a great variety in this country in terms of how environmental education and environmental literacy is taught in our schools. And so it kind of depends on where you live, and it depends a lot on the resources that are available and how those resources are being allocated in school. So for example, you know, in our book, we talk a lot about how environmental education, it is interspersed throughout the NGSS. There are a lot of life science and earth science standards in that framework that speak directly to environmental education. And so schools in states that follow that framework, they are getting some environmental science education. It's just kind of interspersed, and it's not a distinct discipline. In some schools, including ones that I've worked at, as when I was a classroom teacher and an instructional coach, there was environmental science that was available as an elective that students could opt into. But again, you had to make room in your schedule, and there's lots of competing interests. And so there was no guarantee there. And there are some states, like, for example, California, they actually have adopted an entire environmental literacy framework that says that all students really need to experience this in some way and leave their K-12 education really having a really robust understanding of our environment and the forces that are interplaying there. But what's really kind of been missing in what we focus on in our book, my co-author George and I, what we focus on is that there's this interdisciplinary element. Mm-hmm. There are certain parts of environmental science that don't necessarily lend themselves to a discrete scientific topic. You know, we really need to focus and study that discipline through multiple subject lenses. And that's why we felt like project-based learning is the ideal way to do so, because it is more interdisciplinary by nature. And that really does help students understand that the complex problems that we are dealing with and grappling with as a society require multifaceted, interdisciplinary, complex solutions as well.
Yeah, I love that kind of cross-curricular piece, right? Those interdisciplinary connections. You know, I'll share that I took, I want to say I got a 4. I don't remember exactly when I took the AP environmental science exam as a high school student. I think 4 is probably a safe number to give a shout out for.
That's a good score. There you go. That's
Right. So proud of it. I know I was happy at the time, but there's just a lot of variety that I've seen, right, in my own teaching experience and spending time in different schools. You know, we talked earlier about how, you know, I taught in a traditional public school. We received magnet funding. Our magnet theme was environmental stewardship. And it was a lot of what we talked about. How is this going to look in a persuasive writing unit? What are we going to be able to do in a social studies unit that feels connected to this big theme? And so, you know, you mentioned your new book that George and you wrote on environmental science specifically for secondary, so grades 6-12, and that subtitle of, you know, a project-based approach to solving the Earth's most urgent problems. And I love that connection to action for students. So, you know, you mentioned a little bit already, but what role does PBL play in environmental science education?
One of the points that George and I make in the book that I think is really important to highlight is that environmental science really is taught best in a way that is authentic, in a way that's inquiry-based, in a way that's experiential, and that's really focused on real-world problems and helping students to create and think about their own solutions to those problems. You know, so PBL is a framework. It's a way of teaching that actually provides avenues and mechanisms for all of those things to happen. Project-based learning is done in a high-quality way using a model, for example, the Buck Institute's gold standard model for high-quality project-based learning. That's a great example of one that includes all of those things in the designs of projects. And so what you have is you'll have students, even if they're unfamiliar with what a learner-centered approach to that kind of teaching can, they can follow that model, they can integrate those elements into their work and or into their lessons, and they can make those experiences for students even without a ton of training or a ton of experience themselves. It's a great way to get started, for example. Another thing that I want to also highlight is we were really kind of lucky with the timing of our book, because as we were writing it, the Lucas Educational Research Foundation came out with a study. They released a long-term study that was done, focused specifically on environmental science in the AP classroom, kind of like one that you shared having an experience in. And this research took place mostly on Title I schools. So schools where, you know, with students that are further away from opportunity than other ones tend to be. And what they found at the conclusion of this study was that if project-based learning was used to teach environmental science at the AP level, that the students scored higher on the AP than they did with the traditional method. And so I actually got to interview the executive director of Lucas's research arm, and she basically summed it up by saying, we know it works, we know it works for everyone, and now we can measure it. And so we have the research to back up that what we're saying is true. It's not just us thinking that this feels better. We always kind of knew that PBL was the best way to do it, but now we have definitive proof that in that environment at the AP level with students in Title I schools, this is the way that you should be teaching environmental science if you want to get those high level outcomes.
Yeah, and gosh, I would imagine too that as you're thinking through what this looks like, right, environmental education, PBL pieces with students of all ages, there's just a level of buy-in and engagement, right, that students have when they are identifying a problem, when they're working to locate solutions. You know, is that what you're seeing in terms of topics students want to explore?
Yeah, it really is true, because another aspect of project-based learning that makes it so powerful is that it does tend to revolve around problems or challenges within the student's worldview. Every community in our country, in our world, you know, globally, is struggling with some sort of environmental challenge or choice. You know, depending on where you are, it might be an issue of water access, it might be an issue of air quality, might be an issue of ecosystem preservation, could be issues around, you know, the struggle between development and the preservation of public lands. But every community can identify with this, and students are well aware of those things. And I mean, at the end of the day, I think that students really do want to be solution oriented and be a part of the problem, or be a part of the solving of these problems rather than a part of the problem themselves. And so that can be a really powerful and engaging factor in bringing students into these kinds of experiences and getting them more interested or more vested in their education than they might have been otherwise.
Yeah. And, you know, I would imagine as you're thinking through some of these pieces, you know, I taught in a Title I school in an urban environment, right? So we're in the middle of New York City. And for us, right, this idea of environmental stewardship was very front of mind, even if we weren't, right, in a space that you might think of as traditionally, right, having a big backyard, right, or a big space to explore, or a lot of outdoor space in our school, right?
For sure.
We were really thinking through some of these same pieces that were front of mind for students, even going to a farmer's market and talking about these connections that we have to different places that are growing food, you know, right within our community before that even started happening, right within our school building. So, you know, when we think of these hands-on experiences, we often think of it as a no-tech or low-tech experience when kids are really hands-on deep into something. But, you know, I'm curious, you know, what role does technology play when it comes to a project-based approach?
That's a really great question, because as you kind of said, there are a lot of aspects of environmental science and the professional practice involved that career environmental scientists participate in. A lot of the things they do are very low tech or no tech, you know, these foundational science processes of observation, you know, data gathering, using the experimental process to kind of figure out what's going on in a given area or why certain things are happening in an environment or an ecosystem. Sometimes it's as simple as just being there and looking for clues. But technology is, in all things, when it's used well, it's an accelerator. So it can be an accelerator for good. So if things are going well and you have the skills and the processes are solid and you add technology, you're just going to get there quicker and more accurately. If not, it's going to cause a lot of problems. And so we see a lot of scientists that are working in the field that are combating these major changes and are doing so with the help of technology. You know, so for example, scientists studying coastal erosion, they're using time-lapse photos and digital image technology to see how sea level rise and how the changing of tides and flow patterns are affecting coastal communities or ecosystems along the coast, like salt marshes. You know, there are some, you know, obviously data gathering is something that can be done a lot more accurately, and data can be shared globally to create larger sets of information. You know, the idea of citizen science, for example, mm-hmm. without technology, citizen science investigations would be very difficult, if not impossible, for a lot of places to do, or too expensive. And now, because everybody's got a smartphone in their hand, they can participate in these things and really help monitor lake water quality or monitor, you know, do bird counts to see if populations are dwindling because of this, that, or the other. And in this book, one of the things that we want to do is make sure that we are providing opportunities for students to develop familiarity with these technology tools and these practices. And so we actually borrowed from the ISTE standards. ISTE is, of course, who's publishing this book. And we were very fortunate that we were able to use the ISTE standards for both educators and students to make sure that we were representing the role of technology in the real world in a way that was helping build students into these, you know, 21st century thinkers and problem solvers. And that's something that we connect with a lot in our book as well.
I love the ISTE standards connections. I think sometimes when we're looking at where to start with something, or we're growing our vocabulary around a new initiative, it can be really nice to come back to that set of standards, to use some of that common language in planning. And, you know, you mentioned the citizen scientist piece, right? The ability to really gather data, share data, help grow different sets of data across the world. And, you know, it might connect to this next question, or you might want to take it in a different direction. But, you know, if a listener is thinking that they want to do something and they need a place to start, so, you know, what would be one thing that a teacher, a coach, someone, an educator who's listening in today, something they could do to move the needle to incorporate environmental education into their work? What could they do?
So if people were looking for a great place to get started, one of the things that I would encourage them to do is to look at their local communities, and especially the natural resource or conservation groups and government agencies in their area, and see what's going on there. Like I mentioned earlier, I'm a longtime volunteer with the National Park Service. Okay. And one thing that I know is that there are parks all across the country, even ones you don't have to live next to, that are looking for help in helping to move forward or to sort through and conduct some of these studies, which just require so many hours of you know, people hours to do correctly, and they just can't find enough people. And it's something that they can absolutely jump in on and include as an authentic real world application of what the students are learning. It can be something as simple as going in and manually identifying species from automatic captures. Another thing it could be is participating in a lake or an ecosystem monitoring project that's going on in a natural area close by the school where schools can, you know, like adopt a park or adopt a body of water. I live in Minnesota and we have a few lakes, you know, it said. And it would be impossible for our state to be able to monitor lake water quality without the help of citizen scientists. And you know, you drive more than 100 yards in Minnesota, you're going to bump into a lake, essentially. That's maybe a slight exaggeration, but not much. Any school can connect with the Department of Natural Resources. They have an entire division just for the monitoring of lake water quality, and they can adopt a lake and become a part of the people that are actually doing the work. They can get the little Senshi disc and they can lower it into the water to measure the lake clarity, and they can do the testing, and all this stuff is provided for them. All they need to do is ask. So I would highly encourage people who are interested in getting started, look in your area, look to the different conservation and environmental organizations in your area, and simply reach out and say, I would love to get my students some real world opportunities to explore what they're doing or what we're learning in the classroom in a way that's outside of just the textbook. What kinds of opportunities do you have? And maybe you might even have a suggestion. Say, have you ever thought about doing a citizen science project? I have a group of 35 kids that would love to help out. And something as simple as that might kick off a really great experience for them that they may not get anywhere else.
That is such a great idea, especially for, you know, listeners who might feel like, and I know I sometimes feel this way about something new, right? You don't know what you don't know, right? Or what are the problems in my community? I'm not sure, right? But you might go to someone who has that bank of things that they're working on, whether you've got a group of students who have community service hours and you're trying to make a connection with something that's, you know, close to home, just so many different things to unpack there. So really appreciate that. I feel like it's very actionable no matter where you are, you know, listening in from, to find that community organization, National Park Service in your community that you could reach out to and connect with. And, you know, all the social media connections make it easier, you know, to find people to support remotely. So, you know, before we finish up today, I want to make sure that we learn a little bit more about your new book. I had your co-author, George Valenzuela, who we mentioned earlier on the podcast last year, talking about work within the ed tech space. So what is the story behind the book, and what do you hope readers will learn?
Yeah, George and I, we met in 2015, back when we both became national faculty members of what is now PBL Works and was at the time the Buck Institute for Education. So both of us were very interested in the sciences. Obviously, George has a very robust scientific background and a lot of expertise in many different areas of STEM. You know, we both also had stories, and we talk about this a little bit in our book, of how we came together and how this book came about, that we both had these stories that connected us to the environment in some way. And obviously, you know, our concern, our shared concern for the planet that we all share. And so we had that connection. We had some experiences together. And then eventually ISTE approached us and asked if we would be interested in writing this book. And of course, it was a great way to marry our PBL expertise and our interest in environmental science, and that experience is kind of put those together. What was really interesting too about this book is, obviously, this book was written during the pandemic. In some ways, I feel like it couldn't have been written at any other time, because one thing that we saw, and I mean, we all saw, and I mean, the collective we, is that when people had to go inside to shelter in place, and when we kind of all very much changed radically the way that humans interact with our planet, what did we start seeing? Quicker than anybody thought possible, we saw the air quality improve. We saw, you know, we saw environmental ecosystems that were threatened recover in insane ways. We saw populations of threatened species and pollinators come back in you know, robust numbers that we didn't know were possible. We almost got this kind of this glimpse of what the world could look like, or what a healthier world could look like, if we all made some smarter choices. And so, and most importantly, our students saw that too. We now know that these changes are possible. We know the behaviors we have to alter, and we know that, most importantly, we can make these changes in our lifetime. And that's really something we want people to walk away with this book, is that, you know, our students have seen this. They know that there's a healthy, that the future is more attainable. This healthier, more sustainable future is more attainable than ever. It's attainable in their lifetime. Now we just have to show them and equip them with the skills so they can go out there and they can make those changes permanent instead of just temporary. And so what we really hope is that this book will help teachers to create this next generation change makers and conservationists, and will lead to a healthier planet for all of us as a result.
Well, what an important mission, and so appreciate you sharing just the resource that you put together here to make this actionable and ready to do for teachers in different learning environments. And I will make sure to put the link for listeners right below where they're listening to this episode. So if you're listening in the description for today, you'll find links to the book, you'll find links to the show note. But James, where can listeners connect with you and learn more about your work? Where's the best place for them to go?
So the best place for them would be to either connect with me on my website, which I know you'll include in the show notes. It's festeredu.com, or through Twitter, through my Twitter handle. That's a great place to connect with me. If people have questions, if they'd like to be connected to any of the resources I've mentioned, or they were, or what I'm sharing sounds great, and they would love to get started and just want a thought partner. Of course, I want to make sure that I'm that. I also want to, of course, make sure to also plug my illustrious co-author, George, who has an equally robust set of resources and expertise. I know that he also would love people to visit him at Lifelong Learning Defined, which I know you'll include in the show notes as well. And he's always looking to connect with educators in all sorts of different areas outside of not just the environmental sciences and PBL, but SEL and equity and a lot of other work that he's doing, which is just absolutely amazing and fantastic. And he's a great resource and is always, always interested in sharing his knowledge with anybody who would like. So definitely check him out as well.
Perfect. And I will add to the show notes the link to the episode where he and I talked a bit about all things ed tech. So thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it as well.
It was so much fun talking to James today, and as I'm sure you could tell, the topic of environmental education is one I am very passionate about. But I want to finish off this episode like we always do by thinking of ways to make this information, to make this ed tech easy. First, identify community concerns. Next, try a PBL approach. Then, examine different ways to collect data. And finally, find connections with local organizations. Remember, you can find the show notes for this episode with all of the resources and tools mentioned today, including the best way to connect with James and George and to learn about their book by heading to classtechtips.com/podcast and finding today's episode, number 134. You can also find this information in the description area. Wherever you're listening to this podcast, you should see a couple different links that you can click on. A big thank you to our sponsor for this episode, Tech. I'm so excited to partner with them for a webinar series this fall. It's totally free, and you can join one or all four of these webinars covering EdTech topics like creation in the classroom, assessment tips, and more. Register for the event or sign up to view the replays on their website. Just go to otispd.com, click on upcoming events, and you'll find four free webinars you can join. That's otispd.com. You can also send me a DM on Instagram and I'll make sure to get you the link. If you are listening to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or another favorite app, don't forget to hit the follow button. When you follow along with the podcast, each new episode will download for you automatically so you don't miss a thing. And if you have a moment and are feeling extra helpful today, please leave a rating or review for the podcast. It helps other educators find this podcast when they're searching for topics like EdTech or teaching in their podcast app. And this month of September, I have a few special bonus items for anyone who grabs a copy of my new book, EdTech Essentials. Already have your copy? Send me a message on Instagram or Twitter. At Class Tech Tips is where you'll find me, or go straight to classtechtips.com/book-bonus to request your bonus items. Have a great week and check back on Tuesday morning for next week's new episode.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Easy EdTech Podcast wherever you're listening.